So welcome to everyone. I can already see we have people from Ghana, Germany, London already saying where they're from. So it's really nice to have this sort of broad international scope with everyone joining us tonight. And I am very pleased to be able to introduce you to our guest this evening, Karen Betts, who is the Chief Executive Officer of the Food and Drink Federation in the UK, and who has a very varied and illustrious career. And so we're very fortunate tonight to be able to ask Karen about her experiences and to reflect upon how they might be relevant for everyone here who's joining tonight and thinking about where you are, the careers that you have, and where we are as a society more generally. Karen joined, just to give you a bit of an introduction, Karen joined the Food and Drink Federation in December 2021. And prior to this, she was the Chief Executive Officer of the Scotch Whisky Association for 4 years, representing the Scotch whisky sector in the UK and export markets worldwide. Before joining the SWA, Karen was a diplomat, so she has a really interesting combination of backgrounds. She was a diplomat in the Foreign and Commonwealth Office for 16 years, where she held a variety of posts in London and overseas, including as British ambassador to Morocco and non-resident ambassador to Mauritania and counselor to the British Embassy in Washington. She was also posted to the UK's permanent representation to the EU in Brussels and the British Embassy in Baghdad. In London, she served in the Cabinet Office and the Joint Intelligence Committee, as well as in several roles in the Foreign Office. Before joining government, Karen was a lawyer at Clifford Chance, working in London and Hong Kong. Karen is an advisor to the UK government's Board of Trade and received an OBE in the Queen's Birthday Honours in 2022 for her services to international trade. I'm going to begin with a series of questions and see where the conversation flows. So what I'd like to do is open thinking a little bit about your past experience, Karen, because you've had this extensive career in government and as a diplomat prior to working for the Scotch Whisky Association and the FDF. And I'm wondering how your background in diplomacy has informed your approach to your work for your current organizations. Is there any relationship between those experiences?
Well, thanks very much, Elizabeth, and thanks very much for that kind introduction. So yes, there is definitely a connection between what I was doing in the Foreign Office as a diplomat and what I do at the Food and Drink Federation now, or at the Scotch Whisky Association previously. I think that, I mean, they sound quite different, but actually in many ways, the skills that I use are very similar. In the Food and Drink Federation and the Scotch Whisky Association, those are trade associations. So we represent the industry, we represent the industry to government, to regulators, to governments overseas, and you know, try to create the best environment within which food and drink companies or whisky companies can succeed. So, I mean, as a diplomat, you do a lot of that, but to other governments, if you see what I mean. So as a diplomat, I was overseas in Morocco or the United States or in Europe, representing the interests of the UK government to other governments to make sure that their foreign policy aligned with our goals and our interests as far as possible, or where they were doing things that we thought perhaps countered our interests, we were able to, you know, to talk to them and try and persuade them to do something differently. And it's very similar what I do now. I, you know, represent food and drink companies to the UK government, to the devolved administrations, talking to them about whether it's food safety regulation or sustainability regulation, you know, new regulation on packaging. How can we make that work the best, both from a public policy point of view, but also from a commercial point of view? So, you know, fundamentally, the economy can thrive. I also, as a, you know, as a chief executive now, similarly to being an ambassador, you run an organization, got to make all the bits of it work, you represent your, you know, I represent our companies now in the media, much like I did in Morocco for the British government. So there are lots of other pieces that actually, in many ways, are remarkably similar. So there are real sort of real similarities. It sort of surprises me often that more diplomats, when they want and need, as was the case for us to be in the UK a bit more, don't do more of these sorts of roles.
That's really fascinating, and I. I'm also thinking about how when you are in a diplomatic role, what high levels of cultural intelligence you have to have in order to be able to have those discussions and negotiations across what could be very different sets of understandings of certain situations, of, you know, values that are being applied, priorities, et cetera. Do you find that in the more domestic realm within which you're working with these organizations, that you're still needing those same high levels of cultural intelligence to apply within this realm?
That's a really interesting question. And I think you kind of do. When you're in the Foreign Office and you're trying to influence another government to do something in the way that, you know, the way that we wanted them to do it, you can't tell anybody what to do. All you can do is try to work out how your interests align, or, you know, put yourself in the other person's shoes. How does it look to them? And what might I say that would actually resonate with them and help them to think, yes, you know, let's work together, let's collaborate on solving a shared problem, essentially. Mm. And that is very much what I do now in many ways. You know, I can't tell the UK government or the Food Standards Agency or you know the trade directorate within the European Commission. We can't tell them what to do, but what you are trying to do is find a way to solve the problem in a way that satisfies shared interests. And I think that cultural piece is really it's really interesting, because you know it's a bit like when you go and work in America, you assume that you understand America because they speak the same language, and then you get there and you realize how vastly culturally different it is. Well, it's probably a bit like that with all sorts of institutions. You know, if I look at different departments of government now, the ones that we work with, actually within themselves, they're quite different culturally. There are cultural and specific institutional interests that, yes, you kind of want to try to understand. There is a subtlety to it, I suppose, to influencing anybody. But yes, I think there is a cultural angle to influencing in the UK as well. And I mean, to an extent, what I do now becomes party political as well. You know, you may be trying to influence politicians in a political party to put pressure either on their own government or as the opposition. So again, yes, you've kind of got to be alive to what's important to those sets of individuals. And how do we, as I say, create a collaboration around solving a shared problem?
Mm. Well, I very much sympathize with what you say about the American and British cultural differences, because when I moved here 17 years ago, I also thought, oh, it's this. I'd lived in Russia before and thought, oh, it's going to be the same sort of idea. But in fact, it's very culturally different. There's so many nuances. So it's really interesting to hear you speak about that. I just have one more question, if you don't mind, on this area, which is, do you have any sort of examples of something from your experience in the diplomatic corps, your government experience, that you think of as very formative for you, that it's putting you on the spot, because I'm asking if you have an example, but to share with the others about something that you found really challenging or difficult that you worked your way through and that became an important learning point for you?
I mean, there are probably lots of things. I think off the top of my head, I would say that the transition from law into government was pretty formative. So, I mean, I'm really glad I studied law and practiced it for a while, because it's been such a fantastic foundation to everything that I've done since. You know, being a lawyer teaches you to strip a problem back to first principles and to understand how it started, and then try to find where the legal solution is. What is your advice to your client going to be? And I think it took me a while to make that sort of cultural shift when I moved to government, because I was very used to, in law, there being a right and a wrong answer. And yeah, you know, there was, you could work out what the law was, you could work out if it was a piece of litigation or something that where case law applied, you could look at what had happened and you could kind of work out what a plausible answer was. I think when I came to government, I kind of struggled for a while in that, you know, very often there isn't a right or wrong answer, and the problems are sort of multifaceted and often quite dynamic. Mm. And you have to be able to read you know, whether you are working inside a government or outside a government trying to influence in, you've got to be able to read the politics and the humanity of it. And by the humanity, I mean the how would a politician respond to a constituent on this issue? Because that will always be the way in which they react. And that informs so much of how government behaves. You know, as an official, you're taught not to put advice to a minister unless it's realistic. And so you've got to kind of be taking all these things into account. And I remember putting up some very, very worthy advice quite early on in my time and it getting knocked back and thinking, well, you know, how could that happen? I think that's right. I think that's the correct way of looking at it. And I mean, it may have been the correct way or it may not, but it wasn't subtle enough. And I think so, you know, that transition was quite interesting. And I think the other thing that was quite interesting in that transition, and I mean, I think this has only got worse, is, again, you go into government from law. Law firms were quite well resourced. And, you know, you would be working on a case and there would be enough people on it. And if there weren't enough people on it, you would ask the client to pay for another associate solicitor or maybe some paralegals. In government, there were never quite enough people. And the pace is quite, you know, pacey. And of course, 24-hour media makes that even more the case. So again, I found it a bit traumatic at the time that you had to come up with answers and solutions and advice to ministers quite quickly. And then the issue, a decision would be taken and the issue would move on. And yes, I wanted to think about things for a bit longer. And that wasn't, there wasn't really an opportunity to do that. Having said that, then you get into it. And, you know, that pace is quite motivating, actually. And your ability, one of the things I really enjoyed about it was the fact that, you know, if things were happening fast, a minister was only going to read two pages. So if you couldn't get your advice and your recommendation onto two pages, then you know, the minister's office didn't want the submission. And that, you know, that is very disciplining exercise. And I, you know, I've used those skills really in government, but really ever since.
That's so fascinating, this idea of how much cultural difference we find just in the kind of sector or the types of organizations, how much that makes a difference in terms of what becomes a difficult shift or challenging shift. And it brings me actually very, very cleanly to the next question, which is about uncertainty and about those gray areas and when things aren't clearly right or wrong, which is about what you've experienced as the CEO of the FDF, just as we were experiencing the impact of the pandemic and the turbulence of Brexit and economic inflation and the war in Ukraine and the cost of living crisis, really huge amount of turbulence in our economy, our society. And I'm just wondering how you've navigated that. How have those issues affected your role at the FDF as CEO?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting question. And, you know, I think it might take me a while on reflection to be able to answer it. You know, it's one of those things, COVID is one of those things that is not quite settled in my head about what it, you know, what it did to us as a society, to organizations, and then to individuals and to leaders. I think, so yes, I joined FDF in December 2021 after, yes, I mean, the world had sort of pretty much come out of lockdown, although we weren't completely free of COVID restrictions. And it did feel like, I mean, I joined, it was a bit of a COVID uptick that Christmas, and then we were meant to be on our way out of it. And I think the restrictions were starting to be sort of completely lifted late January, February. And I think companies in the sector and probably everywhere were thinking, oh, thank goodness for that. You know, everybody's triple vaccinated now. We can start to get our organizations back to something that equates to normal. And then very quickly, we were into the Ukraine crisis. So we hadn't quite got out of COVID. And then suddenly Ukraine happened, and that did have a big impact on the industry. There was an immediate sort of food, fuel, fertilizer problem. So in our sector, it hit very quickly in sunflower oil, actually. So Loads of sunflowers are grown in Ukraine, and the processing of sunflower oil happens in Eastern Europe. And sunflower oil is in lots of things. It's in, you know, cereal bars and ready meals. It's also in the cooking oils that we use, and that, you know, that that food manufacturers will use to make ready meals and all sorts of things. And so very quickly we were into kind of difficult conversations with the Food Standards Agency about, well, what if we can't get sunflower oil? Because companies quite quickly were saying, you know, we've got 3 weeks supply and then it's done. And so if we were to substitute with vegetable oil, can we do that? And how would you label for it? What happens if your label already says sunflower oil, but what's in the packet potentially has got a mix of sunflower oil and vegetable oil? So very quickly we were into all of these things. And I mean, it was an interesting time to start in that way, because I didn't really have time to catch my breath before these things were hitting us. And, you know, very quickly we sort of reformed crisis teams internally to, you know, to deal with the different things. There was something around food substitutions or ingredient substitutions, something around sanctions, because a lot of our companies had Russian subsidiaries or were selling products into Russia, and some really difficult judgments to be made there around what is essential and non-essential food. You know, should they continue to supply baby milk but not chocolate bars? Really tricky. I think the way I dealt with it really was, you know, what you'd learned in COVID and to a degree previously in, you know, in various crises I worked on in the Foreign Office as well, you kind of have to get to quite a high level of comfort with ambiguity. And, you know, you've got to keep things moving, and you've got to keep decisions being taken without ever really feeling that you necessarily have all the information that you would like to take the decision, but there isn't time to get it all. Or if you can't take the decision, you're going to hold up something else. So, you know, everything is a kind of a sort of balance of ambiguity, a balance of risk. Do I have enough information to take what feels like a sufficiently informed decision that we can do this, we can move on? And I always used to say to my team at the time, I still sort of say to them now, you know, it's okay to take decisions when you don't have all the information, as long as you've gone through a defensible process. As long as if somebody turned around and said, why on earth did you do that, then you could say, okay, this is what, you know, this is the pressure we were under, this was the information that we had, these were the judgments, so this was the analysis we made, and this was the judgment that we took. I think there's also something, you know, quite critical internally around pulling teams together, being very clear with people what it is they're doing, you know, setting up all your things like call logs and action logs to make sure that everybody knows what they're doing, and that things, you know, don't get identified as being dealt with and then get forgotten about. And that whole thing around making sure that you've got sufficient resilience organizationally, that if people are, you know, working really hard for long hours, that you've got people to substitute them with, that you know you can then say to somebody, okay, you've done enough, you know, you need to go home, rest up, someone else is going to do this for a while. But I mean, it is tricky. And I do think that we, you know, the world has become a bit crisis prone, and how organizations deal with that is quite interesting, because the Ukraine crisis obviously hasn't even gone away now. You know, we're left with not so much the ingredient problems in food and drink. Those have pretty much been resolved one way or another, but the energy side of it is still, you know, risky, difficult, costing companies a lot, certainly. So yes, there is a question, I think, for all of us around how you make sure that you give crises, ongoing crises, sufficient attention, whilst also enabling people to refine that degree of normality that we all need if we're going to keep sort of gas in the tank to keep going.
So that leads to another question about this focus on ambiguity, being able to make decisions even when you don't have all of the information, being able to have the sense of having gone through the processes effectively, so you have a legitimate sense that you made the best choice you could in those circumstances with what you knew. It also makes me wonder about what you look for in people that you hire, or that you want to bring on, or that you want to have on a team. Do you find that now you would look more for qualities of resilience, ability to tolerate ambiguity than you might have looked for in the past? Are those qualities that you find yourself actively seeking out in people that you work with?
So I think they are definitely things that you want to know are present in your organization. Now, I mean, I think when I think about recruiting people for my leadership team, I think I would kind of want those things anyway. You want to be recruiting somebody who has a, you know, sufficient maturity, I suppose, in their experience that they have, you know, they've dealt with intellectually challenging problems and complex moving problems enough to have an instinctive sense of, you know, where you start and where you go to and how you bring something to resolution. I think you look for people who have got ways of being resilient, because, you know, I think on any leadership team that's required, you know, has somebody developed the coping mechanisms whereby they can, you know, really focus on a problem, crack through it, but then, you know, understand how they take that pressure off themselves, you know, the time they take off at lunchtime or in the evenings, the fact that they are building sufficiently resilient teams. Because I think at the end of the day, those things probably already existed anyway. You know, you need a balance of skills across your team. The resilience thing is really interesting because it comes up all the time in reference to young people. You know, young people anymore. And, you know, I think it is a learned skill, definitely. I don't think that lots of people have it right at the outset, and it does test your motivation a bit. But so, yes, that is something definitely that organisations need to build up in their staff and make sure they've got across their teams. But I think I would have said that pre-COVID anyway.
Maybe this also leads to the next question, which is having to do with International Women's Day and the fact that you're a female CEO. And we see more women in leadership positions of that kind today than we did even just a few years ago. There's increasing numbers. But I wonder what your thoughts are about the whole discussion around leadership styles, because there's been a lot of discussion for years about whether women in leadership positions have to act, and I sort of put the air quotes, like a man, right? Or whether they have to act like a woman, right? That there's some kind of specific inherent qualities that women have that are supposed to create good leadership skills. And I just wonder what your experience, because you've had high-level posts both in government and in industry, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are about being a woman in leadership role. Do you see yourself as having specific traits that you have to bring to it that you would gender? And yeah, just your thoughts generally.
So, I mean, an interesting one. I think that the culture around leadership has changed and is changing. So I think those sort of female quotes, the sort of empathy, compassion, collaboration, that, you know, have tended to be labeled as sort of air quote, female traits, I think that they are much more recognized as essential parts of leadership than they used to be. So I think that, you know, you see across leaders, men and women now, much more of a balance of, you know, maybe some of the more directive styles of leadership balanced against the empathy, warmth, compassion. And I, you know, I genuinely think in a leader, you do need a balance of skills, because there are sometimes, I mean, in a crisis, you do need to be a bit more directive. You do need to pull that skill out of the bag. You've got to, you know, tell people what to do, when it needs to be done by, and then take decisions quite rapidly off the back of that. But equally, I think that yes, those softer leadership traits are really important, and I think they are modelled by women successfully, and I think that is partly what has softened and changed leadership. I think it's brilliant that there are many more female role models out there who have been walking and talking those sorts of skills, such that has sort of entered the leadership psyche. However, having said all of that, I think that change, the sort of cultural change of leadership, I suppose, takes time. And you know, I don't think, I mean, I report to a board now. So in some ways I'm my own boss, but of course I report to a group of people. But it is different for me now because I run an organisation. I felt quite strongly when I was still in government that the older you got, the harder it became on diversity. So when I first joined government, it was pretty much equal in terms of men and women joining. But of course, the further up you got, actually the less equal that became. And from a gender point of view, that was quite a lot about decisions that families were taking one way or the other about who was, you know, who was going to bear the burden of childcare. And, you know, I don't know whether that has changed in government or organisationally and, you know, in other big organisations since I left, because I think there's something a bit insidious about it. So we think that leadership is changing, and indeed it is. But I think at the highest levels, you can still feel like, like you stick out a bit. Mm-hmm. As a woman, let alone as a person of diversity. Mm-hmm. You know, people of colour, women of colour are, you know, much less prevalent than women. Mm-hmm. In general. So I think it has all changed and is continuing to change for the better. But I think we do still have to agitate for change, because otherwise the pace is really slow. And as I say, as you get to those senior levels, there still aren't as many women there as, you know, as I think we might all like to see.
Do you think that there are any areas that we might be missing or not addressing when it comes to enabling women? You talk about that very important gap that occurs when people are making choices about family, et cetera. And a lot of women who might choose not to pursue a role because it would mean that they don't get to be with their children during younger years as much as they would like to, et cetera. If you're working 18-hour days, you know, in a crisis, that kind of thing. Do you feel that there are any kind of social approaches that we might be missing that would really make a big difference in terms of enabling women to have more of an equal playing field when it comes to taking on those types of positions?
I think it's partly social, it's partly about organizations, and it's partly about individuals. Yeah. So, you know, if you start with the organizational bit in the middle, organizations do have incredible power to increase diversity. And, you know, and making quite small changes in organisations have, you know, statistically been shown to make, you know, a really good difference. So, you know, the fact that in the way in which companies treat women as they go off on maternity leave and come back again matters. The way in which organisations can take skills learned outside the organisation, take account of them in women's careers, perhaps if they've taken a career break, really matters. So you're not sort of, you take your 4-year career break, you're not necessarily pushed back the whole 4 years when you rejoin. I think COVID has been quite helpful in really demonstrating that flexible working can work. And I hope that that has opened sort of pathways for women who were already maybe flexibly working in some way flexibly, but where the organization hadn't quite come to terms with that. I mean, the statistics on that are really interesting. It was something like 5% of the UK population used to work flexibly pre-COVID. Now it's more than 30%. Mm-hmm. I think so. That's got to help women and men with some of those sorts of issues. I think when you get onto the social and individual stuff, it's kind of in some ways harder to talk about, but I think it is really important. I always say when I speak to young women about these sorts of issues is you need to have that conversation with your employer about how they support diversity within their organisation, and, you know, make sure that the organisation doesn't become too monoculture, particularly as you move up the leadership pipeline. But you also need to have that conversation at home. It's the tangled weeds question, I always say. You know, when you reach down and find tangled weeds that are difficult to untangle, I think you have to have that conversation with your partner. You have to have that conversation with your parents and your in-laws so that people understand why you want to work and why working perhaps when your children are small is about an investment in your career and in having a satisfying and fulfilling, you know, long life. Because sometimes I think it's not so much, you know, partners understand that sort of thing. But then, you know, when your mother-in-law comes over and rolls her eyes and tuts about your, you know, her grandson not being able to do his maths homework, and was that because you were concentrating on your job more than whether or not he was picking up key skills at school? I mean, that, you know, that is really hard for people, I think. And finding ways into those conversations that don't strain family relationships but enable people to say what it is they want out of life is really important. And then, yeah, there is a social thing there. You know, you look at some other countries where it's much more common for both couples in a relationship to work. So Scandinavia. And, you know, that is, there is an acceptability around it, I think, not least because of the availability of childcare. You know, some of Eastern Europe does that really well as well. So there are questions about how we move everybody's perception of working parenting, I suppose.
Yeah, it's really important what you're saying about how it sort of feeds in this in kind of insidious way in which it can feed into everything from the conversation taking place at the school ground gates between the parents who are working or not working, or the dad who is home with the kids and isn't working, and what kind of pressures are being put on every area. So kind of surfacing those seems like a really important aspect of what we can do in addition to these other things that you mentioned. I wanted to ask you as well on a kind of more specific note about your work with the FTF. About, it's very open and broad in general, but what do you see as the future for food and drink in the UK in terms of any transformations in how we approach it? One of the things, we're all aware of the cost of everything going up in the grocery store right now. And there, you know, recently we had this case of the fruits and vegetables not being available on the market shelves. I wasn't able to get eggs in Cambridge for about a month. So is it going, are these kind of stresses and tensions that we're facing, do you see a change in how we think about food, what's available to us, having food available to us from all parts of the world all throughout the year? Do you see a kind of paradigm shift going on, or is it just we're in a moment where things are challenging?
I think we are in a paradigm shift one way or the other that I think, you know, will span quite a significant period of time. But, you know, there is nonetheless change, I think. I mean, I think if you look sort of pre-COVID, what we had was a generational achievement in our food system, really. I mean, in 2020, on average, households spent 11% of their household income on food and drink in the UK, compared to in 1970, households spending 25% of their household income on food and drink. So relatively, the food system has become much less expensive over a period of 50 odd years. And that is really to do with, you know, efficiencies in farming, efficiencies in manufacturing, and the food system's ability, I suppose, to respond to changes in our lives. You know, food becoming fresher, well, being able to be kept fresher for longer, being able to be convenient, all of those sorts of things. I think, though, that we will find that 2020 was probably, as low as food prices can go. And that then comes into questions of sustainability, really. And I mean environmental sustainability, but of course it's actually about the fundamental sustainability of our food system. I think that what we, you know, COVID and Brexit and the Ukraine war combined have been a bit of a toxic mix. So that has given us a sort of wicked problem to deal with in the here and now. But in some ways, I think it's helpfully shone a spotlight on some of the pressures that the food industry, the food system was coming under anyway, that we need to be able to look at and deal with. I think that there are significant issues that are being tackled, but will probably need more and faster work around, for instance, the sustainability of crops, mm-hmm. the sustainability of some sorts of farming and some methods of farming, the sustainability then of some of the things that we want to eat and drink. I mean, you know, I think the consumer will continue to demand the range of choice that we have, but, you know, it may be that there isn't quite the massive choice that we have now. I think you ought to be able to buy tomatoes and cucumbers in the winter, and that was a weather event. Mm-hmm. But there is a word of warning in there for mm-hmm. us. And, you know, one of the things that put pressure on the tomatoes and cucumbers a couple of weeks ago is because of the energy crisis, there's been less farming of tomatoes and cucumbers in the UK in greenhouses or in polytunnels because they've been more expensive to heat. And so I think we probably do need to confront that. And that is about cost, because those farmers will say that they didn't plant tomatoes and cucumbers in the UK because the heating of those polytunnels would have been prohibitive and they wouldn't have been able to, to make their cost back from the retailers. So that, I think, does start to pose us some interesting questions about diversity of supply, about how we deal with those questions around, everything from the cost of energy that also impacts the cost of fertilizer, through to the relative costs of importing some things that we could grow in the UK. So I think it poses a lot of questions at the food system in the round, and I mean everything there from farmers through to manufacturers through to retailers and hospitality. And, you know, I think we will crack those, but I don't think it's going to be easy. And one of the things that makes it harder, that somebody said this to me the other day, and I thought they'd nailed the point, that, you know, you kind of know, for instance, what the car industry is doing on environmental sustainability. You know, we know about the development of electric cars, battery issues. Maybe we'll be able to power them with hydrogen at some point. You know, you might have an idea of what the aerospace industry is doing on sustainability. Do you know what the food system is doing? No, because there are many, many, many more actors, you know, everybody through from small businesses to large businesses in all sorts of different parts of the sector. So I think over time, there will need to be much more focus on how the work going on in different parts of the system is going to tie up to make sure that that the food system is as sustainable as the population needs it to be over the coming, you know, decades.
Yeah, thinking about ambiguity, just as you're describing that, I'm thinking everyone is a stakeholder.
Yeah.
There's not a stakeholder. So that's a massive undertaking to sort of address the issues of all those stakeholders in that particular industry that you're leading.
And I think that, you know, humans have been incredibly innovative and ingenious over the years. So I think we will get there. But yes, I mean, it's complex and it's challenging, and it will require, you know, an amount of innovation that we haven't got to yet, and lots of clever thoughts and lots of collaborative working globally, really.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure there might be questions about that when we come to questions, but if I can close with one more question for you before we turn it over to the audience. We were speaking just before we came on with the audience about what you'd been doing for International Women's Day, and I was just wondering if you would like to speak a little bit about that to the group.
So yes, I mean, you asked me what I'd done, and I said I haven't gone mad with International Women's Day today, but I did go to Slough this morning and speak to a group of teenagers in a relatively deprived area about jobs and careers, and, you know, what life might throw at them, and it was really interesting. I came away really reflecting on what more we can do to connect with young people coming out of school who may go into work straight out of school, they may go to college, they may go to university. How do we help young people in situations where they might not always have role models very readily available, or, you know, they may not have families or friends who are particularly helping them for a variety of different reasons towards careers that they might find fulfilling? And yes, it sent me away thinking What more could we do? It was a really interesting group of young people who, and I'd said to the teacher beforehand, you know, how long should I speak for? And will there be many questions? And he said, oh, I don't know, they're quite shy. Don't know if there'll be too many questions. But then obviously he had he'd prepped them a bit, and I got some brilliant questions. So yeah, really, really interesting.
Well, I want to thank you so much for answering my questions this evening in this interview. And I think I can probably speak for everyone in saying how interesting it's been to hear what you've had to say, but also the sense of real sense of your complexity, the sort of complex intelligence and humanity that you're bringing to the work that you're doing and to the way that you're approaching these questions. So I just want to thank you so much for speaking to us all about that. And it's really been an honor. So I'd also like to give the others an opportunity to ask you questions, if you're happy to take a few minutes for questions. And I see one from someone on the right saying, what were the risks you faced working as a diplomat? So did you experience any risks? And also your experience of other cultures, which you spoke about a bit, but maybe there's an interest in hearing about any danger stories that you had.
I mean, there were a few physical risks. I spent quite a bit of my career on national security issues when I was in government. And so, yes, I spent some time in Iraq. I spent some time in Afghanistan. I spent some time on the Iran nuclear negotiations. I mean, in terms of physical risks, I don't think that many, really. Some, but probably not as dramatic as you might think. I mean, Iraq was, yes, I was based in Iraq during what was a sectarian civil war, and I was based in a particular part of Baghdad that was relatively well protected. We did have an amount of rockets and mortars fired at us, and we had quite a lot of routines that you would go through, and you know, ways of dealing with that. And so, yes, I mean, there was some risk that definitely added to the added a sort of frisson of danger there. It was also really interesting. You know, we had a really, really tight team there. You know, it was one of the most satisfying things I think I ever worked on, because you've got, you know, a relatively small, quite close-knit team doing, you know, trying to help a country by that stage work through its issues, and such that, you know, the war wouldn't continue. I mean, I say that one thinking, crikey. I'm not sure how successfully I particularly contributed to that. But on all of those things, yeah, there was also massive interest as well. And you know, you got to be involved in things that otherwise I never would have been involved in. And it was, you know, really interesting and actually really revealing of human nature. You know, whether you're in negotiations where you're putting, you know, your top line forward and working out where your negotiating fat is, watching the other side do that in a very clever way was always fascinating. And I, you know, the cultural aspect of any of those sorts of things is really interesting. And one of the things I really enjoyed about the Foreign Office is, I mean, I'm no linguist really, but they do teach you languages, and that just gives you a massive insight into somebody else's culture and how they approach things. I always found it fascinating, the word you know, the words you would learn where other languages have a word for a concept that we don't. Mm-hmm. And you know, it would kind of make you think, well, that's interesting. What cultural route does that come from? So yeah, it was really fascinating, and I was very lucky to have done the things that I did. Mm.
So you have a lot of questions over here, so I'm going to try to just pick through them and choose a few. One of them is speaking to the question about your role as a woman in leadership, and this person is asking, What advice would you give to women entering into the business world and in the UK for the first time? So they want to know specifically about business in the UK. What would you suggest to someone just entering that area?
Well, I think you should go for it. And I think you should do what you want to do. And, you know, I definitely believe strongly that if you want to do something and you enjoy doing it and you're motivated to do it well, you're much more likely to succeed than if you go into something because you think you should do it or because someone else is pushing you towards it. So, you know, follow your heart, follow your interests, do what you want to do. I always, you know, and I was talking to the group this morning about then the difference between confidence and competence, which I think comes up for women a lot. And, you know, I think women are really good at getting their heads down in a low ego way and, you know, learning about things, working things out, coming up with solutions, running teams in ways that you can find solutions. So I do believe that, you know, that being competent at your role is really important. And that then may give you the confidence that you think you may not have as you push yourself up that leadership ladder. It comes up a lot that women lack confidence. And you know, and in some ways, I don't think that's a bad thing. I think questioning yourself and kind of thinking, oh, did I come over really badly then? Or did I take the wrong decision then? Is not a bad thing to do. What you mustn't let it do is undermine you. You mustn't end up second guessing yourself such that you pull your punches and that you don't take decisions that actually afterwards you're kicking yourself for and thinking, well, I could have made that decision. I could have put myself forward for that thing. Of course I can do it. But yes, be competent and then, you know, build your confidence off that. And yes, I mean, the other thing I would say, I don't know, did I mention this earlier, is embrace difference. You know, if you're feeling different in a situation, it's probably because you are, you might be the only woman in the room or the only person from your ethnicity, or you might have a disability or whatever it is. I think my best advice on that is embrace it and make a virtue of it. You know, get everything out of being different that you possibly can, because actually often, you know, I always used to think, and particularly when I did national security jobs, when you're doing a lot with the military or other organisations in that sort of realm, you know, very often I was the only woman in the room, but people sure remembered that I'd been there. Whereas they may not have remembered the ranks of men who were there. So, you know, find your strength in that difference and embrace it and don't be afraid to be different in those circumstances. And then, yes, use your empathy, your collaboration, your warmth. I think it goes a long way with people. And you may get teams responding to you much more positively in that way than they would, you know, if they were told in a gruff way what to do or told off for doing something wrong. I think that would be my advice. And I suppose my only other bit of advice would be find your balance within your home and your work life. It isn't easy. If it was easy, we would have worked it out, but we haven't worked it out, and it's difficult and it's very personal, but find ways of making that work for you and make sure that others are giving you the support that you deserve.
I'm just letting you know that I'm going to be quoting you extensively in my leadership classes for these points, because you're really affirming so many things that I think actually many people entering into business or whatever field it is, they want to believe that that's true. They want to believe they can bring their compassion and their diversity and their self-questioning. You know, it's okay not to feel already completely confident at 22, and to build that as you go and to ask yourself along the way. So I think that these are just wonderful ways to kind of, from someone who knows, from someone who's in a leadership position and has been in leadership positions. So that's a very convincing model for what a strong form of leadership that is. So I'll be stealing from you for my classes, quoting you. Just one more. I think we just have probably time for one more question. Although there's so many good questions, I'm sorry to those of you who won't get one in for now. But this is, I think this one is a nice question, which is from a civil servant who's listening with us today, who says, can you tell us about a time you failed at something and how you picked yourself up and carried on and what you learned? Do you have an example of having failed at something?
Yeah, I mean, I think I have certainly failed to get jobs that I wanted or promotions when I wanted them. I mean, those are the things that stick in my mind the most. I mean, life is littered with small failures, and many of those you brush off quite quickly. I think, you know, the job ones are the ones that I found the most disappointing, I think, you know, when you've kind of, and especially in the Foreign Office, where you would be bidding for a job and it would involve moving your family to that place. And so, you know, you'd have to have the conversations with I'd have some conversations with my husband, we'd have to look at the schools, you know, will it work? And by the time you've gone through all that, you've invested so much in it. And then if you don't get it, I used to think, God, you know, how could I have answered that interview question so badly? How could I have crashed and burned? And I think, you know, from those moments, what's kind of important is that you ditch it all for a while, but you don't talk to yourself with it. I mean, that's just life, isn't it? You don't... things don't always work. And I think you've got to distance yourself from that for a period. And then just work out what you've learned from it, because you will always learn something from it. And I suppose it's the same with things at work where, you know, you get things wrong. And often they, you know, hopefully you're not getting things dramatically wrong. But yeah, you'll make the wrong judgments. You know, and I've definitely done that in the last year in my job, I think, because especially when you come into an organisation as the leader and you're new, hey, you know, you're operating on gut instinct for quite a long time where you're thinking, okay, well, from what I know, this seems like the right answer. And you know, I'll check it with other people and then you'll do it. And sometimes it turns out to be right and sometimes it turns out to be wrong. So, yeah, don't beat yourself up. Make sure that at some point when the thing isn't so raw, that at some point you just scrub it through and make sure that you've learned something from it and that you've internalized that somehow. I think the other thing that's really important, and especially as you go up that leadership ladder, is kind of being comfortable with vulnerability. You're not always going to get things right. And it's okay to fail at things. You know, hopefully you don't drop the biggest ball and it crashes at your feet. But it's, you know, it is okay to get things wrong. And it's okay to be able to say to your team, that didn't go so well, did it? Now, you know, what might we have done differently if we'd known the things then that we knew now? Or what might we do differently next time? And in fact, that team bit, that team vulnerability is really important, because I think the people around you have to learn that failure is okay, because it's that whole thing. I remember being told as a kid when I was learning to ski, you know, if you don't fall over, you're not learning. And I think there's definitely something in that. If you're so safe and conservative that you never put yourself out there and take a bit of a risk, then you're probably not stretching yourself as you should do, and you won't be learning and progressing as you want to. And the other thing, I suppose, about the vulnerability bit is if you put it out there, then it's not such a big thing either, you know. So we failed at something. Let's work out what we're going to do differently and let's move on. And yes, let's not blame anyone for it. That's the other thing. Don't blame your team. Don't blame yourself. Take responsibility for it. But blame has no place in being accountable. Mm.
If I can actually steal the last question by tagging onto that one, you are obviously exemplifying these behaviors and traits as a leader. Do you have ways in which you try to inculcate that in the organizations that you work with, other than being a good role model? Do you actually have ways to encourage people to feel more okay with their vulnerability or asking for help or relying on each other, these different types of things that can be quite scary for people to do?
I think there's an amount of role modeling. There's an amount of kind of setting the circumstances and then stepping back, allowing people to get on with, you know, so you've asked them to do something, you've asked them to get somewhere, you've asked for an output, and giving people as much guidance as they want, but letting them get on with it. And then, you know, working out what you've learned. I'm a big believer in training and coaching and helping teams to develop the ability to be open with each other and to use each other as peers or as teams somehow. I think that's really important. I think lots of things we need to do at work are not things that naturally come to people. You know, management, leadership, all of those things are much more learned skills than they are innate with any of us. So I'm a big believer in you know, building organizations that are founded on continuous improvement and investing in teams and allowing them to invest in each other. And I'm not, I have to hold myself back sometimes. I hope I do it enough. You know, when you know you've got to deliver something and you've set somebody off and they're kind of, you know, riding their bike as you would have watched your kids and it's a bit wobbly, I do have to hold myself back sometimes when I think, you know, I'm going to turn away and let them get on with it. Because otherwise they're not going to learn anything. But sometimes that is, I do find that hard. Mm. And yes, I think you'd probably have to ask my team to really get a rounded answer to that question.
Well, I suspect your team would have very positive things to say, but we'll have to check in with them another time. So we have reached the end of our time with you this evening. And I just want to thank you so much again for being with us, for taking this time out of your schedule and for answering these questions in such a really open-hearted way. And there's several comments also in the sidebar speaking about how helpful it's been, how much they appreciate it. So I think everyone wants to thank you so much for being here this evening. I don't know if Maria wants to close with any other final thought.
Just to thank everybody for attending and a special thanks for Karen. Not many of you know, we've been trying to get Karen to do this for about 10 months. So that's how busy she is. So thank you, Karen, for your time. I know you've got an incredibly early start tomorrow morning. And Elizabeth, you've got a meeting to go to after this. Thank you so much. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.